From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, journalist Alan Nairn tells us what he witnessed when he was arrested and detained last month in East Timor. He was reporting on the militias that terrorized the capital after the people of East Timor voted for independence from Indonesia. Nairn was banned from East Timor in 1991 after he tried to stand in the way of Indonesian troops, which massacred hundreds of civilians. Also, we remember basketball great Wilt Chamberlain with an excerpt of a 1991 interview. He was found dead yesterday at the age of 63. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate has voted on the nuclear test ban treaty. The votes are still being tallied, but the Senate is expected to reject ratification of the accord. Senate Democrats failed earlier today in a final attempt to postpone the vote. Republicans said the treaty should be rejected because it's not fully verifiable. The United States continues to call for a swift restoration of democratic rule in Pakistan, where military leaders staged a coup yesterday. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Instability in Pakistan is a matter of concern for the United States because the possibility of nuclear war between Pakistan and India is ever present. In remarks at the University of Maine, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright warned that the coup in Pakistan has created a new level of uncertainty on the subcontinent. Albright said Washington wants a return to constitutional rule so that U.S. officials can continue the work they've been doing to try to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan. She noted that the military takeover in Pakistan makes it difficult for the United States to carry on business as usual. We expect them to return to democratic rule, Albright said, and want to hear what their plans are. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
A spokeswoman for the district attorney's office in Boulder, Colorado, is expected to issue a statement soon about the JonBenet Ramsey murder. Grand jury members who've been investigating the case went home today without any comment from district attorney Alex Hunter. The grand jury has until October 20th to report on its investigation. The president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, delivered the backing of his organization today to Vice President Al Gore. Gore's only challenger, former Senator Bill Bradley, had asked the unions to delay the vote. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Los Angeles.
The AFL-CIO called the Gore endorsement the first major victory in the contest between the two candidates. President John Sweeney said the 68 Union Federation chose Gore because of his voting record on behalf of working families, from wages to health and safety. The endorsement was not unanimous. Some unions, including the Teamsters, said they preferred to wait and let the nomination race run its course. Sweeney said the early nod was necessary because of the front-loaded primary process and the tide of corporate money that has swamped the political system. We will carry him, Sweeney said, and he will carry us. The reason why the endorsement is so critical is obvious here in the huge convention center, where thousands of Democratic activists in T-shirts milled about, all potential campaign volunteers well-trained in getting out the vote. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 185 points to close at 10,232. Declining issues led advances in active trading. This is NPR. Russia has kept up air raids and artillery attacks on what it calls terrorist bases in Chechnya, but fighters in the breakaway region are vowing to crush any attempt by Russia to advance further. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The Chechens say they've been carrying out hit-and-run attacks in northern Chechnya, an area Russia says it's under its control. Chechnya's president has warned the fighting will intensify if the Russians move toward the capital, Grozny. His representative to Moscow said Russians aren't hearing the full story. He spoke of heavy civilian casualties, saying the Russian air and artillery raids have been striking villages and hospitals, not rebel bases. But Russian military officials insist they are succeeding in their drive to rid Chechnya of terrorists. Troops moved into Chechnya following two Chechen-led raids into another southern Russian republic, Dagestan. Moscow also blames Chechen warlords for organizing terrorist bombings in Russia, though the Chechens deny this. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
An independent counsel said today that there's not enough evidence to indict Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt in connection with his handling of an Indian casino license. Independent counsel Carol Elder Bruce said in a statement that her 19-month investigation did not uncover evidence that Babbitt committed perjury or any other criminal act. The statement said that Bruce will not attempt to prosecute and will not seek an indictment of Babbitt or anyone else. The independent counsel investigated allegations that Babbitt lied to Congress when he explained why the Interior Department denied a permit for a casino requested by three Indian tribes in Wisconsin. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Nairn, is an American journalist who was arrested and detained for 6 days last month in East Timor. He was reporting for The Nation magazine and Pacifica Radio on the militia attacks on Dili, the capital of East Timor. The pro-Indonesian militias terrorized the population after the people of East Timor voted for its independence from Indonesia on an August 30th referendum. International peacekeepers have since moved in, and the UN is planning to run a transitional administration for the next couple of years. Indonesia invaded and annexed East Timor in 1975, just days after it ceased being a Portuguese colony. Nairn was banned from East Timor in 1991 after he witnessed Indonesian troops massacring hundreds of East Timorese. Nairn's reports on the massacre won a Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award and a DuPont Broadcast Journalism Award. When the violence erupted following the August referendum, most of the foreign press evacuated East Timor. I asked Alan Nairn why he stayed.
Well, the Indonesian army, through its militias, was still attacking the Timorese, and the danger was increasing daily. And to the extent that there were witnesses, people from the outside who could see what was happening and tell the outside world, that hopefully would provide a little bit of protection for the Timorese. So I wanted to stay.
What are some of the things that you witnessed after most of the media left? And about what date is this?
Well, it was the week leading up to September 14th when I was, that's the day I was arrested by the Indonesian military. A lot of the media had left about 10 days, 2 weeks before that, and there were some reporters still in the UN compound. What was happening on the street at that time was that the militias were burning down Dili. They were going at the houses of independence activists and their families. They would ride up on their chopper motorcycles and in trucks, shooting their guns into the air, honking their horns. And then they would go into the houses that had been targeted by Indonesian military intelligence, and they'd loot them, set fire, and move on to the next house. They burned down hundreds of houses. The central business district of Dili was completely destroyed, just a cinder. There were no, hardly any major public buildings left. You didn't see any normal traffic on the streets. All that remained of the traffic were refugees, militias, and military vehicles. There was smoke everywhere, constant gunfire. And by that time, many of the neighborhoods of Dili were empty. I went out early in the morning in the Via Verde and Mataduro neighborhoods of Dili near the National Cathedral. And most of the houses were open. I would hide from the militias by just ducking from one house into another. And it was easy because the doors were open. You could just walk into someone's living room, their bedroom. The place was abandoned. The residents had either fled up into the hills or had been taken away at gunpoint by the army, the police, and the militias.
Where did you sleep while you were hiding from the militia?
Well, in different places. Sometimes I was in private, empty houses. sometimes I was in the UN compound. For the Temerese, though, they had no final refuge. I mean, while the UN compound was open, that was a final hiding place for foreigners. But if you were a Temerese, except for the 2,000 or so who got into the UN compound, and they were mainly UN staff and relatives, you had nowhere to go, because even the most inviolate places, the places that had been safest in the past, the International Red Cross headquarters, the home of Bishop Bello, they were also attacked and burnt.
What information were you able to find out about who was in the militias and who controlled the militias?
Well, the army controls the militias. When I was held at the Coram military headquarters after being arrested, the whole back portion of the base was full of uniformed Itaric militias with their black T-shirts, their red and white headbands. You would see them going out onto the streets in their chopper motorcycles and their trucks with their rifles to stage their attacks on Dili. And I asked one of the officers there who was questioning me, Lieutenant Colonel Willem, are those militiamen there? And he said, oh, yes, we have them here on the base. They live here. They work from here. It's so we can control them, he said. At the Polda police headquarters, where I was also interrogated, you would see the uniformed militiamen going into and out of the intelligence and operations centers. They were really an arm of Indonesian military intelligence. Some of the militia leaders were Timorese who had for years been on the militia payroll. I'm sorry, on the military intelligence payroll. Many of the rank and file were street criminals or young unemployed men who had just been swept up by the military and told that they were now in the militias. Some were brought from Indonesia, from the eastern islands of Indonesia. And increasingly, especially in the final weeks of the operation, many Indonesian troops were simply dressed up in militia uniform and sent out to do the attacks themselves. And all of this was coordinated on a day-to-day level by Kopassus, the special forces troops.
Let me ask you what might be an obvious question. What's the advantage to the Indonesian military of having militias under its control? What can a militia do that the military can't?
Well, I think they thought it gave them some deniability. It didn't get them very far, but I think that was the idea, that they could say the militias are out of control, we can't restrain them. It did succeed in putting some distance between the top commander of the Indonesian military, General Wiranto, and the militia terror. Even today, when the U.S. State Department finally, after all the terror, came to admit that the military was behind the militias, they only say it's elements of the military. They don't acknowledge what Western military people on the ground in Timor acknowledge, and that is that this is an operation run from the top by General Wiranto. It's obvious when you're there because it's such a vast, tightly coordinated operation. It involves both the army and the police, and the only person to whom both the army and police report in the Indonesian structure is General Wiranto.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Nairn. How were you arrested on September 14th in East Timor?
I was walking in the morning on the streets of Dili and was just picked up by the military and taken to the Coram military headquarters. That Coram was the central command for the occupation of East Timor, headed by General Kiki Shianakri. He was head of a body they called the Committee for the Restoration of Peace and Stability.
So when you were picked up, did they know who you were? Were they out for you, or were you just another random person who was rounded up?
They didn't know who I was. I was just a foreigner on the streets of Dili, and they seemed pretty astonished to see me on the streets, because at that point, the buildings were just smoking. There were hardly any people left. I had been told earlier that the militias had been looking for me as an individual. But when the army picked me up that morning, they didn't know who I was. That didn't come out until I was interrogated later in the day at Corum headquarters.
You were interrogated. What were you asked about?
They wanted to know who I knew, what Indonesians, what Timorese I knew, who I had been speaking to, why I was there, where I had been, and also what my motivations were, what my political motivations were in being there.
Did you answer any of those questions?
I didn't tell them anything about who I'd been speaking to, and I didn't give them any details that they could use to track people down, because that's what they were after. But when they asked the opinion questions, I answered, very honestly. I told them, for example, that I was there reporting on the militia attacks, that it was clear that the regular army and General Wiranto was coordinating these attacks. I said I was also reporting on the U.S. support for the Indonesian military. And then in my view, although Wiranto and the army were the principal culprits, the U.S. and President Clinton also bore some of the responsibility because they had been arming and training and financing this army. So I told them exactly what I thought.
Well, I'm sure that really made you Mr. Popularity. I mean, that seems like a pretty risky thing to say.
If I had been Indonesian or Timorese, it would have been very risky because... I've interviewed Timorese who've been tortured in that very Corum headquarters. But because I'm a journalist, a foreigner, an American citizen, and also politically notorious there, I really was safe. There was no chance that they were going to hurt me. They treated me with kid gloves. They did threaten me with jail. They said I could get 10 years in prison, and at one point I was formally told that I would be prosecuted and jailed the following week, but they never laid a hand on me. I had a lot of political protection around me just because I was not an Indonesian or a Timorese.
How many days were you in prison?
6 days. I was held for 6 days first in Dili and then in Kupang and then brought to Denpasar before I was deported.
What were the conditions like in the prison, and is this a prison that you shared with people from East Timor?
No. Well, when I was in Corum, I was held in a room in the military headquarters and was surrounded by soldiers. Then in Kupang, I was held in what they call quarantine, and then in Bali, likewise. In Bali, there were some Afghan and Iranian detainees who were also in the quarantine, but I was never together with any East Timorese. It's interesting in the Indonesian prisons, the way they work. Kind of as a rule of thumb, if you're not being disappeared or if you're not being tortured, you sometimes have more leeway than you would in, say, an American prison. There are many stories of prisoners, especially political prisoners who were able to maintain contact with the outside world, able to meet people, able to maneuver in a way that you would never be permitted in a U.S. state or federal prison. For example, I was able to keep my cell phone, and I gave interviews. I made calls to the outside world. Never would that happen in any circumstances in an American lockup.
Were you able to recharge the battery?
sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I was actually able to get to an outlet. But because I was getting very privileged treatment. They didn't quite know what to do with me. The decision was bucked up to Jakarta, where the generals were and Wiranto were basically deciding, and they got a lot of pressure, public pressure here on Congress and in turn on the State Department. So in the end, they decided to just deport me.
My guest is journalist Alan Nairn. He was arrested and detained in East Timor last month. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is American journalist Alan Nairn, who was arrested and detained in East Timor last month while covering the militia attacks on the capital. Now, you were deported to West Timor. Whose hands were you in West Timor?
Well, they from Dili, they flew me on a military charter to Kupang, West Timor. The flight was very interesting because, well, first we were due to go on a C-130 transport plane, a Hercules, one of the planes that the U.S. has supplied to the Indonesian Air Force. But we couldn't get on that, myself and my military escorts, because it was packed with the booty that they had just looted from Dili. They were carrying on motors that had been ripped from their casings. They were carrying on television sets, even an entire fuel truck. They were rolling onto this this massive transport plane, and it was just so packed that there was no room for us. So we got on a later military charter, myself and the military escorts, two MPs, military policemen, and we were followed on the plane by about 50 or 60 men in militia getup with the black T-shirts, many of them still holding their long rifles and their swords and their automatic pistols. I recognized some of these men from the streets of Dili as being street-level militia leaders, but it turns out they were all actually policemen. They were all members of police intelligence, as my escorts explained, working in plain clothes. They had completed their one-year rotation in East Timor with the militia operation, and now they were being shipped back to West Timor. So we flew back to West Timor, and there I was, you know, the detention continued, and I was questioned by immigration officials and police intelligence.
Do you think that the authorities who were holding you realized that they were giving you more information by detaining you than you would have gotten on the streets if they'd let you go free?
Well, that's a good point. I don't think they did. I actually had a very good vantage point that first morning in Koram, because I just sat there for quite a few hours as, you know, one would question me, then another would question me, and they couldn't quite figure out what to do with me. And sometimes I was near a window or several windows, so I could see what the militiamen were doing in the back. I could see that parked in front of the headquarters, there were actual ITARIC vehicles. ITARIC is the name of the Dili-based militias. And they had these old blue Dili taxi cabs that they had repainted with the ITARIC name on it. And there it was parked right in front of the military base alongside the military intelligence vans with the blacked-out windows. And then sometimes they would drive me across town to the Polda police headquarters for interrogation there by police intelligence. And just by being driven across Dili in that way, I could see the scope of the devastation, and it was just astonishing. I mean, to anybody who knows Dili, when they go back, they'll be stunned, because it's really it's almost the destruction of civilization there. And I was able to see all that as I was driven back and forth for the various interrogations. And in fact, in the police headquarters, as they were interrogating me, right outside the door, they were also building a bonfire of documents. Police intelligence was burning their own documents, their own surveillance and interrogation reports, because, as the interrogators explained to me, they were about to evacuate. They were about to get out of Timor. And in the confusion and chaos there at police headquarters, because it was pretty disorganized at that point, at one point I was actually able to see a police intelligence document which described the forced relocation of the Timorese in detail and made clear that this was a formal military operation. The name of the operation was Operasi Hanoin Lorosai Dua, and they actually broke down by army base and by police base how many East Timorese they would be responsible for capturing and taking out of East Timor. And they gave an overall figure for the number of people they had taken to that point. This is now
about 3.5 weeks ago, and the figure was in excess of 323,000 people, which is an astonishing figure. It's almost 40% of the population. When I first read it, I found it hard to believe, but a little later, Bishop Bello and then the UN came out with estimates that were similar or even higher. So this means, in essence, that they abducted about half of the Timorese population.
How were you allowed to go home?
Well, I was picked up on a Tuesday morning. On Friday, after quite a few days of interrogation, they told me formally that I would be charged starting the following Monday. And they actually said I would be charged and then sentenced to 10 years in prison. They assumed the outcome of the trial. But then the next day, they said that decision had been reversed, and that they announced I would be deported instead. And that was as a result of the pressure from the public and Congress here, who they weighed in with the Indonesian military and with the State Department to put pressure on Jakarta. And so at some point, I think Wiranto decided it just wasn't worth the bad publicity, and they just decided to get rid of me.
Alan Nairn is an American journalist who reports for The Nation magazine and Pacifica Radio. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, U.S. support for the Indonesian military. We continue our conversation with journalist Alan Nairn. And we remember Will Chamberlain, who was found dead yesterday at the age of 63. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with American journalist Alan Nairn. He was arrested and detained in East Timor last month while reporting on the militia attacks on the capital following the East Timorese vote for independence from Indonesia. When he returned to the U.S., he testified at the House International Relations Subcommittee on Human Rights about the new material he found on U.S. support of the Indonesian military. What did you learn about U.S. support of the Indonesian military?
Well, it's been extensive, much more than the Congress realizes. And it has also been intensified during the months of the militia terror in Timor. The dimensions include training programs. Congress thought they had cut off the military training for Indonesia. But it turns out that there are a series of training programs being run by a host of federal agencies, including the FBI and the CIA and the DEA, and also some local authorities, programs under which Indonesian police and military intelligence people are brought here to the U.S. and are receiving training, contrary to an understanding that exists between the Congress and the executive branch. Also, it turns out that the U.S. has been shipping in spare parts and ammunition to the Indonesian military. And in fact, a fair amount of that ammunition was used in the militia attacks in Timor. There's, I got photographs, for example, from an Indonesian infantry unit in Timor, Battalion 744, showing new boxes of U.S.-supplied ammunition. These were from Olin Winchester of East Alton, Illinois. And later, when the militia rampages were happening and I was walking the streets, you would see discharged shells, cartridges everywhere. And a number of those came from this this U.S. firm. And then in addition, there's also a large series of contracts and joint ventures between big U.S. companies like General Electric and General Motors and Textron and the strategic industries of the Indonesian military. These are the industries that run the communications and the logistics and make the bombs and so on for the Indonesian army. So there are many, many lines of support.
Alan, you were reporting on East Timor for a long time. I think it's fair to say that East Timor really entered the American consciousness pretty recently. Why did you cover it long before it became a really big media story?
Well, for many years, I've tried to go to places where the worst atrocities are taking place and also where the U.S. is directly involved, since I'm an American citizen, and try to expose what's going on, try in hopes of making an issue of it, in hopes of stopping some of the killing. So I had done that kind of work previously in Guatemala and El Salvador and Haiti and a number of other places. And unfortunately, if you make that your mission, there's a long list of countries to choose from, and Timor is one of them, one of the worst cases. It's really inexcusable that the press, the big press, the corporate press in the United States did not put Timor on the front pages from the very start. Because what happened there in the past few weeks, and that really shocked and astonished the world as it did get coverage, that's not new for Timor. It started back in 75. From 75 to 78, the Indonesian invading force staged a mass killing that eliminated about a third of the original Timorese population. But it's only recently that the press discovered Timor. Some amazing figures I found from looking at the archives at Vanderbilt University of the broadcast media. The night after the invasion of December 7th, 75 was the invasion. The night after the invasion, Walter Cronkite read a 40-second item on the CBS Evening News announcing that the invasion had taken place. That was the last mention on the CBS, NBC, or ABC Evening News, the last mention of East Timor for the next decade and a half. It wasn't mentioned again until after the 91 massacre that I happened to survive, along with Amy Goodman of Pacifica radio. So that's the decade and a half of the slaughter carried out by this army that had direct U.S. backing, and yet it was not deemed newsworthy. That's not a very objective application of the standards that the press professes to use.
Let's go back to 1991. You witnessed a massacre in Dili and survived the massacre yourself. What was behind this massacre?
Well, it was a crucial moment for Timor. There was a UN Portuguese delegation, Portuguese because Timor is a former Portuguese colony, and the UN recognizes Portugal as the administering power, even though they're not present on the ground in Timor. There was a UN Portuguese parliamentary delegation that was due to visit Timor, and the Timorese were very excited about this because they hoped that this would finally lead to enforcement of those two UN Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to get out. But the Indonesian army warned the Timorese that if they tried to meet the delegation or demonstrate in front of them, that they would kill them all. They actually said publicly that they had already dug the mass graves. Well, it turned out that at the last moment, that delegation was canceled under pressure from the governments of the U.S. and Australia. And that cancellation set off a train of events that culminated in a march, a procession from the Motael Catholic Church to the Santa Cruz Catholic Cemetery, a procession by thousands of Timorese who were commemorating the death of a young man who had been killed by the army 2 weeks before. And as the procession got to the cemetery, where they had been holding up signs and chanting against the army and the occupation, the army marched on the crowd. And at the time, I thought we could prevent an attack by just standing between the soldiers and the Timorese, myself and Amy Goodman, because the soldiers would see that we were obviously foreigners. We were obviously journalists. We had the cameras and tape recorders. But that didn't work. We went and stood in the middle of the road as the soldiers marched up, hundreds, maybe thousands of them. The crowd was defenseless. They were hemmed in by the cemetery walls. There were thousands of Timorese there. But the soldiers just marched right up to us, enveloped us, and as they got a step or two past us, about a dozen yards from the Timorese, they just raised their rifles, their US M16s, all at once and just opened fire on the crowd. And they just slaughtered the people systematically. It was indescribable.
How many people were killed?
Well, nobody knows exactly, but after the fact, the Timorese managed to piece together a list of their estimated list of the dead. That was 271. The bodies have not been recovered. They were either dumped at sea or dumped in mass graves, and many of the wounded were finished off in hospital beds with knives and iron bars. And the next day, General Sutrisno, the National Armed Forces commander of Indonesia, gave a formal speech where he said, "These people are disruptors. Such people must be shot, and we will shoot them." And then after that, the State Department announced, the U.S. State Department, that they were going to double military training aid to Indonesia to teach them democratic values. But that never happened because public grassroots activism mobilized here in the U.S. That was the beginning of the East Timor Action Network, and Congress voted to eliminate the military training aid for Indonesia. And that was actually the first of a series of congressional moves that started to change U.S. policy in the direction of pulling away from the Indonesian military. This is very much against the will of first the Bush and later the Clinton administrations.
Were you injured in this massacre?
Yes. They fractured my skull with the rifle butts. And at one point, they had Amy and myself down on the ground, and they put their rifles to our heads. And they were screaming at us, and they were screaming, "Politique, politique, politics, a crime in Timor." And we had committed politics by being there. And it seemed they were deciding whether or not to execute us. But when we convinced them that we were from the U.S. as opposed to, say, Australia, that really seemed to turn the tide. And they took the rifles away from our heads. I think they realized that there would be a price, or there could be a price to pay if they killed Americans. You know, we were from the same country their weapons were from, the country of their sponsors, and I think they didn't want to get into risk that trouble. Earlier, in the earlier years of the invasion and occupation, they had executed an entire Australian TV crew, as well as the Australian wire service reporter Roger East. But I think being American made us a different case.
Looking back, do you think it was a little naive to think that you and Amy Goodman could have stopped the military from opening fire on civilians?
Well, it turned out to be wrong. I think if there had been a few more of us, a few more foreigners out in the open, present up front, I think that probably would have stopped it. I think just with two, there wasn't enough of a critical mass. One thing I'm convinced that could have stopped it was there was a UN official there at the time, Mr. Kuimans, the special rapporteur for torture. He elected not to be at the scene. I think if he had been there with all his UN authority, I think that might well have stopped the massacre. But it happened. They slaughtered the Timorese. It really looked as if at that moment, I think the Indonesian military thought that the Timorese movement was crushed, but they turned out to be wrong because the Timorese didn't give up. Organizing got going here in the United States and in other countries. And a number of years later, that resulted in some substantial cutbacks in U.S. support for the Indonesian military. And that, I think it's pretty clear, was one of the main factors that motivated Habibie, the Indonesian president, to finally agree earlier this year to allow the vote in Timor, to allow the U.N. Supervised vote that resulted in the overwhelming mandate for independence.
I'm wondering if you ever think it's possible that you've gotten too close to this story, that you're too emotionally involved in it, in part because you've been the victim of the regime that you've been covering.
Well, I'm like all reporters. I'm part of the story. I mean, it's a myth of American journalism that reporters are not political actors. Every reporter is a political actor. The only question is whether they recognize that and whether they are honest about it. If a reporter basically reports day to day what the State Department is saying, what the White House is saying, they're serving as a political actor in echoing their agenda. The role I choose to play in this is I'm trying to stop the killing. I'm trying to bring to light so the American public can see what role the U.S. is playing in this and let the public decide whether it's right or not. I think it's wrong. I think we should not be arming, training, and financing this murderous army, and I'm very clear about that. And when I do the reporting about what's happening, I'm very careful to make sure that all the facts are accurate, and I better be because, you know, if I get anything wrong, I'll hear about it immediately from the Indonesian military and the State Department and the Pentagon and so on. So I'm very careful to be completely accurate, and I want to stop the killing. That's clear.
Alan Nairn is an American journalist who reports for The Nation magazine and Pacifica Radio. Coming up, we remember Wilt Chamberlain. This is Fresh Air. Wilt Chamberlain, one of the most dominant players in basketball history, was found dead in his home yesterday of an apparent heart attack. He was 63. When the 7-foot-1 Chamberlain joined the NBA in 1959, he was virtually the tallest player in the league. His nickname was Wilt the Stilt. Chamberlain was one of the best shooters in the history of the game. At various times in his career, he led the league in scoring, rebounding, assists, and blocked shots. He averaged 50 points a game during one season. In 1962, he scored 100 points during a game against the Knicks. Chamberlain played for the Philadelphia 76ers and the Los Angeles Lakers, retiring from the NBA in 1974. He was back in the news in 1991 after he wrote an autobiography in which he claimed to have had sex with 20,000 women. We're going to hear an excerpt of my 1991 interview with Wilt Chamberlain. Was your height always an advantage on the court?
Well, you know, height in most sports can be an advantage, like basketball, but a lot of times it was a disadvantage because of how people viewed me. And what I mean by that is they gave a great deal of my accomplishments they credit to being 7 foot tall. That indeed bothered me because I like to deem myself as being a good athlete, possessing some of the qualities and characteristics that would make a good athlete in speed, stamina, agility, and those kind of things. But a lot of people only saw it as a height factor. And most guys of my era, and even of this era, you know, when you're this tall, you have to deal with those legs and arms. It's not as easy as people think it is. I was lucky. I was gifted in those areas. So physically, it wasn't a barrier, but mentally, it definitely was.
Well, one other question about your height. What kind of reactions do you get from people who don't know who you are, who don't figure out that you're Wilt Chamberlain, and they see you when you're very tall?
Well, let me say this. When I was young, you know, I was viewed as a freak. It's not a kind thing to say or a kind thing to feel. They really looked at me as young that way. But as our society has evolved and sports has become so prominent, once people see you, they immediately think, basketball and dollars, you know. And I mean, you know, and so they see this great dollar machine, you understand. And at 55, people say, hey, what team do you play for? You know, whether if they don't know me, they assume right away that I play for some professional team. And that to them is a bonus because all professional basketball players, the average one makes $1 million a year. So you have to have, you know, some real good luck going for you.
Right. Do you think that basketball has gotten taller on the whole?
You know, a lot of people say that. A lot of guys who want to equate the fact that maybe the basketball today was better than yesteryear because the guys are bigger, faster, and stronger. Well, that's a lot of hokey-pokey. Basketball players, if you compute the averages of 1960 and compute the averages of today, the 1991s, there's only about maybe an inch in difference in size, an inch going in favor of the guys of today. But if you take away some of the extremely tall guys, the Manute Bol out of Philadelphia, 7'7", and a few other guys, 7'5", and 7'4", and you take them out of the lineup, the averages were pretty close to the same. And the guys who are the stars in the league were always about the same size, 6'6", 6'4", 6'5". So it has not changed very much as far as height's concerned.
So from what you've been saying, you don't think the basket should be raised in basketball?
No, I don't know how much the average person really truly knows about a trajectory and about the game of basketball. But if you raise the basket, you would only make the game more applicable for the taller player because the balls would come off the rim a lot higher, so therefore they would have the advantage even more so. What you do is you widen the courts and you do some of the things that they're now doing by allowing the lanes to be more wide open so the quicker and more agile players get a chance to move around better. That's the best way to maybe to, you know, if you think that you need to legislate a little bit against the tall guy, which they did as I was coming along, they changed rules to legislate against me personally.
Yeah, well, why don't we bring that up? They changed offensive goaltending because of you. You want to explain what this is?
Yeah, well, offensive goaltending is when your opponents shoot the ball, and you are allowed to go up while they shoot the ball and maybe guide it into the basket or aid it or help it or just grab it and just throw it into the basket yourself. And they said it was unfair because I used to do that with great frequency, and the defensive player is not allowed to touch the ball once an offensive player shoots it while still going up. So it was something that I was able to do that other guys couldn't do, and, you know, and so they made rules against it. They widened what is considered the lane in which you have 3 seconds to cross. From the time I left college, they widened it so wouldn't allow me to be close to the basket. They did things like disallow you from dunking the ball, which from the foul line, they said that you had to stay behind the foul line. Before, you could put your foot across the foul line as long as the ball went into the basket before it was down on the other side of the foul line. They changed those rules. You used to be allowed to throw the ball over the backboard on out-of-bounds play, but because I could jump so high and no one could control me putting the ball in the basket from that way, they said that was illegal and made you have to pass the ball from the sides rather than over the backboards. There were a few things that they did.
We're listening to a 1991 interview with Wilt Chamberlain. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Let's get back to our 1991 interview with Basketball Hall of Famer Wilt Chamberlain, who was found dead yesterday at the age of 63. Now, you started with the Harlem Globetrotters, and you played with them for how long?
I actually played with the Harlem Globetrotters for 17 years. I started with them my first year before I entered the NBA, and I owe a great deal to the Harlem Globetrotters. In fact, basketball in general on the pro level owes a great deal to the Harlem Globetrotters. They used to play doubleheaders in the beginning of the league when they were in financial trouble, and people would come out and watch the Globetrotters, and then some would stay to watch the second game, which would be the NBA game. The Globetrotters afforded me the opportunity as a young man of color to fulfill a dream. I used to dream it one day that I could play with the Harlem Globetrotters and see the world and make people laugh and do some of the fun things you do, but also play great basketball. So when the opportunity came for me, I was quite honored. Even at that stage in my life where some people consider me the best basketball player in the world, my dream was still to want to be a Harlem Globetrotter, not to play in the NBA. And so I got a chance to do just that.
17 years with the Globetrotters. How old were you when you joined?
Well, I started at 21, and I played, you know, right through my whole basketball career. When the season ended in NBA, I would go and join the Globies wherever they were in the world.
Oh. Okay, well, Chamberlain, I think it's time to talk about sex. Now, as we read your book, we learn not only about the basketball records that you broke, but it seems you've broken a couple of sexual ones as well. You estimate you slept with 20,000 different women. And you average that as 1.2 a day since you were 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Who's keeping score?
Who's keeping score? Well, it sounds like the one is keeping score. Let me try to explain that to you a little bit. When, you know, if you have an involvement in life with sexual encounters, as I put it, that consume that much of your life, and you're writing a book about your life and what shapes the ideas and forms some of your opinions in life, you'd be really rather dishonest to preclude that from your book. If I told people I was a basketball player and they say, well, what did you do? Did you score points or what? And I said, yeah, I was a good scorer. Well, what does that really mean? If I tell them that I scored 100 points in one game and averaged 50 points a season one time, they get a better picture of what Wilt Chamberlain was about as a basketball player. So as I was sitting here writing my book, and I'm trying to explain these to my potential readers, some of the things I did off the court and how involved I was in sexual activities, I wanted to maybe keep it personal, but I also wanted to have an idea of just how involved I was. So I went back and checked some of my date books and some of my appointment books and try to remember and recollect. And I would add up, say, 1969, July, how many encounters there may have been, and prorated by 12, and do the same thing for 74 and prorated by 12. Then take those 12s and multiply them by 40, and I come out to the number of 20,000. Now, that may sound like bragging. One was not bragging. One was trying to make a statement, in fact, to show people what I was about. A lot of this happened during the 60s and the 70s when I believe there was a sexual revolution and women wanted to sort of equate with men and have the same freedom as men did. I was young, able and willing, you know what I'm saying? Luckily, I was strong, and I did partake. But I'm not here to promote promiscuity. I believe that this is a different era, and we must be a lot more careful about those kind of involvements, and I practice safe sex, and I just kind of believe that you have to be a lot more selective. I have a great deal of respect also for women, so it wasn't a matter of conquest. This was a mutuality thing where two minds conceived and wanted something, and the bodies did it. It was an era that it happened a lot more, and I'm not ashamed of it. I'm just trying to tell people a little bit about me and what I was about.
You retired at the age of 36, I think?
Yeah, almost 37.
Mm-hmm. How did you choose the moment to retire?
Well, you know, that question has not been asked, and it's a great question because I went to a little island off the coast of Yugoslavia, off the coast of a little town called Split, Yugoslavia, and a friend of mine had a home that summer, and I spent 2 weeks just thinking and getting my thoughts together and seeing where I wanted to go. My 5-year contract was up with the Los Angeles Lakers, and I had to make a decision on what I wanted to do. I just thought it was time to do something else in my life while I was still younger and healthy enough to enjoy it.
I think lots of people try to stay in as long as they can, and mm-hmm. you could have stayed longer.
Yeah, I you know what? I think as I look back now, Terry, that I feel as though there was something else that motivated me. My heroes were Joe Louis and Sugar Ray Robinson and Willie Mays and guys like that. And I watched them in the latter part of their careers, and they were not the great athletes that they were, and I thought maybe they stayed a little too long. And I didn't think of myself as that way. When I left the NBA, I had just broken a record for percent shooting, which may last for quite a long while. My very last year, I was still leading the league in rebounds. I was still the number one shot blocker in the league and considered the number one defensive player. So I was still at the top of not of my game, but of the game in the NBA for the players of that particular time. But I must have thought more about the fact that that's also the time that one should leave is when he's at the top.
Wilt Chamberlain recorded in 1991. Yesterday, he was found dead of an apparent heart attack. He was 63. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Sarah Scher and Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From WGBH Boston, producer of Mystery, airing P.D. James, An Unsuitable Job for a Woman, tomorrow night on PBS. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Trust, the private and powerful family behind The New York Times, by Susan E. Tift and Alex S. Jones, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss presidential hopeful and Texas Governor George W. Bush with his biographer, Bill Minutaglio, who writes for the Dallas Morning News. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.